Now we come to the final part of the journey. Yes, right, Nibbana. I did ask actually just at tea time whether there was any fee for this session today. So because it was a free session, if you don't get to Nibbana, you can't ask for your money back. Which is why we don't charge a fee. So now we come to transforming your mind. This is like the wisdom part. I did try to split the session up today into sila, into the virtue, into meditation in the second session, and now the last session is wisdom, the insight, the understanding, the truth of things as they really are. But sometimes you've got some questions. Very good. Very good, okay. They're questions or they're complaints. So, one interesting thing in one of the teachings of the Buddha is something I emphasize a lot in my talks in Australia and elsewhere. That when the mind is peaceful in meditation, you don't need to say, oh, I'm now going to do insight. The insight flows naturally from a peaceful mind, like compassion flows naturally from a peaceful mind. And there's one sutra I always quote, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's in the nines, I think. There's some questions here. In that particular sutra, it says that for someone who has experience of samadhi, of the peaceful states of mind, they do not need to make an intention to form a decision, oh, may I see things as they truly are. It happens as a natural course, according to the Dhamma of cause and effect, that one who has peace of mind will see things as they truly are. And I quote that a lot because sometimes people think, oh, okay, now I've done samatha, now I'll do vipassana. You don't do samatha. I've already mentioned that. Samatha happens when you're not doing anything. And you don't do vipassana. You don't decide to do insight. If you're doing insight, you're missing the point. Insight happens, right? Calm happens. Now, this is a very important point because if you think you're doing things, you're going in the wrong direction. It's all second noble truth practice, not the letting go practices. Which is such an important point that I spend a huge amount of time talking about that. The other way of describing meditation, which I have had great success in using, simply because it's the way of understanding what is going on, is actually to describe what we mean by the mind. Remember, this is like transforming the mind. To understand what we mean by the mind by splitting it into its two major functions. This is what the mind does. It has two main duties, two main responsibilities. The first thing which the mind, mind's responsibility, is to do things. To think, to manage, it's like the government inside of yourself, always making decisions and managing your body and managing your life, and very often managing other people's lives as well. I call this the doer, the manager, the controller. And I think you will be able to understand what I mean by that. Every time that you move your bottom, every time which you scratch your shoulder, every time you twiddle the knobs, every time that you put your hands over your eyes, every time you put up your cloth, you're doing something. Every time you scratch your head, you're doing something. I'm just watching what people are doing. You scratch your neck, you're doing something. Because this is the active part of the mind, the doer. The second part of the mind is the passive part of the mind. What I call the knower, or consciousness, or bare mindfulness. It's that which knows, that which can hear, which can see, that which can know, the knower. Now is it quite clear, those two parts of the mind? Because once you are familiar with what these mean, then I can go further, having made that distinction between the two halves of the mind, we could actually see what meditation is and what wisdom is. The point is that when a normal state of mind, we do so much, we know so little. Most of our energy, most of our concern is with doing things, with being active, and we know very little. We don't actually collect data. We just manipulate the world. When I say the doer, it means will, action, thinking. That's all part of doing. Bare knowing is just being alert, seeing what's happening, knowing what's happening without doing anything about it. Just looking, just observing. Now the point is that for most people, all our energy goes into doing, into willing, into choosing, into changing things, into managing our lives. That there's very little energy left to know, to be mindful. Which is why the person asked earlier, sometimes when I meditate, I fall asleep, I nod off. And I answered that question by saying, allow yourself to go to sleep, have a rest. Because what happens when you're sleepy in meditation? It means all your energy has been used up in the past by getting here, running around, doing things, clearing up your desk in your office so you're free to come here. You've been doing so much that your energy is very, very low. Now, if your energy is low and you get tired, you get sleepy, what should you do actually to overcome that sleepiness? If you start doing more things, trying to struggle and make war, have a battle with that sleepiness, you just make yourself more tired. You're doing too much and all the energy is being used up. So my answer, which I found out in my own practice, if you're sleepy, make peace with sleepiness. Don't do anything. Allow it to be. Say, sleepiness, the door of my heart's open to you. And when you're not reacting, when you're not doing anything, when you're not trying to change and manipulate your sleepiness, the energy which you have, instead of being all consumed by doing more things, by trying to control and manage things, all that energy is free to flow to just knowing, to awareness, to consciousness. It can either go to one half of the mind of doing, or it can go to the other half of the mind, just knowing. But when you stop all this doing business and just allow the energy to go into knowing, you find your mindfulness gets brighter and brighter. You literally wake up. And as you wake up, the mindfulness begets stronger and stronger and stronger. It's a strange thing to see mindfulness become so bright and so powerful. I've already mentioned one aspect of that is when you have your cup of tea or when you have your meal, it tastes much more delicious. Did you enjoy the cake at tea time? If you did, that was a sign you've been following my instructions. Well done. It means you've just been at peace with things and you have energy to feel and to taste things. You know what it's like when you're running around doing work? Sometimes you grab a sandwich here, you grab some noodles there, you stuff it in your mouth, you don't even know what you're putting in your mouth because you don't even taste it. Now, the point is here that when the energy goes into knowing, the knowing gets so bright, it gets so still, that you can become wise. It happens by its very nature, as you calm the doer, as you calm the mind, as the energy doesn't go into doing things anymore, which is the job of meditation, you start to see more things. You start to get insights. You start to gain wisdom. Wisdom comes from the calm mind. And this is how it happens, that mindfulness gets stronger. Sometimes it's like, you know, that you've got a dull flashlight and you can't really see what's happening. But when you get some new batteries and you can have a powerful flashlight, you can see everything. Everything gets illuminated. This is what I've called power mindfulness or superpower mindfulness. Where the mindfulness, because it's empowered by still states of mind, having the energy just going into knowing, the mindfulness gets so strong you can really see things. It's like if I turn the lights up into this room, you can actually start to see some of the grey hairs in some of the girls. You can start to see some of your pimples. You can start to see the false teeth in the men. Whatever it is, when you turn up the lights, you tend to see much more. This is what we mean by wisdom. It happens by its own nature when mindfulness becomes strong. So by transforming the heart, we naturally go on to stage of transforming the mind. One of the things which we see when we transform the mind by wisdom is just how little we truly own, how little we really do control. Because it's a great saying of the Buddha that people who have big egos have lots of possessions. People with small egos have little possessions. People with no egos don't possess anything at all. I don't mean just how big your house is or how much money you have or how many things you have. That's not what I mean by possessions. I mean how much you're truly attached to. Some people can only have a small few things, but they're really possessed to it. They really have a lot of possessions. Only it's small things, but it's intense. I know some people are very, very wealthy, but they're so kind and generous. They have many things, but they have few possessions. They share things. So people with big egos, what they have, it's mine. And the Buddha actually said, where there's a mine, there you will find a me. There you'll find the ego. And you actually, a lot of people define themselves by what they own, by what they possess. And what you possess, you tend to want to control. That's my house, that's my car. Some people have such big egos, they want to control their husband or their wife. They want to control their family. They think, that's my wife, that's my family. But as you become wise, as the insight gets very, very strong, you realize how little you really own at all. No, truly, is that really your husband? Do you really own them? Can you really say it's my husband? Or are you just renting them for the time being? Really, it's much closer to rental, isn't it? Because you only have them for a time. And then you have to give them back again later on. This marriage is called rent-a-husband, rent-a-wife. Drug venture, yeah. So what it means here is that when we actually see with wisdom how little we own, we truly own, we can actually enjoy our family, but we don't own them. We don't possess them. They actually come into our lives for a short time. We know they're going to leave later on. We can enjoy them while they're here. We can let them go when they have to leave. I know lots of people, because of the illusion of ownership, because we really think that we own our children, we have so much suffering with our children. Really, who do your children belong to? Are they really yours? The point of the matter is that they're just beings who come into your life. You don't know where they came from. They just arrive in your womb one day. And there's a being coming from a previous life with all its old karma. And they come into your life. And you give birth to them, you nurture them, look after them. And sometimes I've seen in Australia and also Singapore, Malaysia, some wonderful parents have monsters for children. They get, can finish their schooling, they talk back, they've got lots of big discipline problems, and they cause so much trouble. And sometimes they come and complain to me, what did we do wrong? We did everything we possibly could for our kid, and our kid's in trouble with the police, and always talks back to steals from us. What did we do wrong? I say, of course you did nothing wrong. Now, even the best gardener, if they've got a poor seed, they can't make a nice plant or flower out of it. You tried your very best. You had just a bad seed, that's all. It's not your child. It's not your son, not your daughter. They came from another life. You gave them a body, you nurtured them, that's all. They're there for you for a time being. But please, don't try and own them and think they're yours. The opposite has happened many times too. I've seen parents who are hopeless parents. They don't care for their kids. Sometimes they're cruel, sometimes they abuse them. And sometimes these children, they just grow up to be amazing people. Just so kind and so intelligent. They get scholarships here and they get degrees and they have a wonderful life in spite of their parents. And sometimes, again, using the plant analogy, sometimes these wonderful seeds, and it doesn't matter who the gardener is, they have no gardener. Sometimes it grows and it becomes a beautiful flower, even without any nurturing. So sometimes you might think, you know, is that my child? Or is that somebody who's come into my life who I'm looking after for the time being? If you realize it's not yours, it's just a responsibility, a person visiting your life for so many years, then it's much easier to let them go. I know that some mothers and fathers have a terrible time with their children. They worry about them and worry and worry and worry. And now I am now 53 and my mother still worries about me. And I think, you're crazy. And I tell people like that who worry about their children, you should be like a bird. Like when a bird, two birds come together and they have their eggs, that one of those birds sits upon those eggs for day after day after day. And if you think you've got a sore bottom sitting on that's nothing compared to sitting on a round egg all day. But they do that because they love their little children. And that when the egg hatches, they have to go searching for food all day. No matter how many worms they catch, that little bird still wants more. And it's an endless task feeding those little chicks. And when those little chicks are big enough, the mother and the father teach them how to fly. But this is where the birds show their wisdom. As soon as their young can fly and feed themselves, right, that's it, you look after yourself now. And mum and dad go on holiday, they never come back. Wouldn't that be wonderful if you could do that? You look after your kids, you feed them, give them education. Once they finish university, out the house, you get your own house now. And you don't worry and care about them so much anymore. Why are we so attached to our children? You know it causes you a lot of pain and suffering sometimes. It's because of ownership. You think that this is mine. It's my son and my daughter. What wisdom says is that we don't own these things. We have duties. When we fulfilled our duties, that's enough. We don't own them. It's the same with your husband, your wife. You don't own your husband, your wife. You do your duties and that's it. If they die, you let them go. It's the same with your body. Do you own your body? Is that yours? If it was yours, you'd be able to control it. Oh, may I not be sick. Sometimes sickness comes at the most embarrassing times. I don't know about you, but I know many of my mates sometimes have been very, very sick, and I made an appointment to go to the doctor. And as soon as they walk into that doctor's surgery, they start feeling well. Sometimes the body is completely out of our control. And when do you want to die? Have you got a nice appointment so you can say, well, it's not really convenient on Thursday, maybe on Friday, maybe next week sometime? Of course, you can't make appointments like that because the body doesn't belong to you. Who does the body belong to? It belongs to nature. So what wisdom shows us when we're very still, we just see how little we truly own in life. When we see we don't own these things, that's when we become detached. When I say detached, it doesn't mean we don't care. We care, but without controlling. We do our responsibilities and duties without thinking we own these things. In the same way, if you rent a car or you rent somebody's house, or if I am just staying in the BDF in my room upstairs, I don't think, ah, this isn't my room. I don't need to clean it up or tidy it up. I don't need to wash my own cups. I do that because I care. Because even though I'm renting this, I've got my duties. So even though you're renting your body, it's only there for time being. You have your duties. But this evening when I leave, I'm not going to worry about that room at all. I'm going to let it go. As soon as this room which I live in, called my body, starts to fall apart, I'm going to let it go. That way, when you can let go of things, it's because you realize you don't own them. And when you don't own them, because of non-attachment, you can really let them go and be free. You transform your mind with wisdom, with non-attachment, with non-ownership. It's all the same of having no self, no ego. There was a question earlier about no ego, or big egos. And as part of ego, which I like to emphasize now, is actually encouraging yourself or praising yourself. Because I make a big thing in my talks that if you are keeping precepts, you deserve praise, encouragement. You deserve a sadhu sadhu. If you've come here today and listened to the Dhamma all day, give yourself a pat on the back. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Praise yourself. If you meditate and do well, give yourself a prize. And sometimes people have complained to me, look, if you praise yourself that way, won't you get a big ego? And the point is that no, you never get big egos by praising yourself. You get big hearts instead. You don't get big-headed, you get big-hearted. And that's a wonderful insight to have. Praise is like encouragement. And when you encourage yourself in things of goodness, you actually do, you get big-hearted. You get less selfish, less sense of ownership, because all the practices of virtue and meditation, they're all practices of letting go, renouncing, freeing yourself. So of course you cannot become more proud that way. It's not gaining more things, but letting go of more things. So we start to get wise. We start to see things as they truly are. We start to see how little we own in life. When you realize how little you own, when it comes time to death, death is so easy. I never own these things anyway. I came into this world with nothing. You came even into this world with no clothes. And so you leave with no clothes as well. Maybe. Certainly you came with no money, you can leave with no money. So what wisdom does, it actually frees you. So you're not worried about things which you don't own. You know, when you own things, it's a burden. It's a worry. The other part of wisdom, which I like to emphasize, of transforming the mind, is we also realize through our meditation that we don't own the past and the future either. They're not ours. Because when you start to own the past, it's like you carry the great burdens of the past with you. And when we think we own the past, that's when we can never forgive and let go of the past. Too many of us in modern life, we've had difficult things happen to us in life. We have had pain and arguments, and people have mistreated us and haven't been very kind. And why do you allow that to destroy your happiness? Why do we carry around things which happened to us many, many years ago and imprison ourselves with the pain of the past? It never makes any sense to me. Because no one is forcing you to do that. You can let go of the past at any moment if you understand non-attachment. If you understand that this is not mine, it happened, I'll let it go. I don't need to actually to attach and carry this around. What wisdom does, it frees you of those attachments. Also, that I was going on about pride a minute ago and about ego. I was very impressed when I read some of the sutras of Buddhism to realize that what I thought was pride was only a third of it. In Buddhism, there's actually three types of conceit, three types of pride. And those three types of pride are, I am better than them. The second type of pride is, I am worse than them. And the third time is, I am the same as them. Because that all comes from measuring yourself against other people. And how can you ever measure yourself against somebody else? It's just like a school, like a school system. How can you measure, say, a child in grade 1 against a child in grade 11 or 12? Sure, that the child in grade 12, just before going to university, can do so much more, they seem so cleverer than the child in grade 1. But the only reason for that is because the child in grade 12 has been in school much longer. They're not better. And it's the same with human beings. You can never say someone is better or someone is worse. It's someone who's been practicing longer. Maybe they have had many, many lifetimes to practice, and other people are only just starting out in the human realm. So how can you actually judge someone is better or someone is worse? How can you judge someone is the best meditator or the worst meditator, or the best monk or the worst monk? It's just that some monks have been practicing longer, that's all. So you expect them to know more and be more developed. Some people have only just started, so you expect them not to be so developed. The point is here, you're not judging people anymore. Some people will get more angry, but you don't see the rotten people, they're just learning. So give them a chance to learn. Don't judge them and say they're hopeless, they're rotten. So when we actually don't compare people, we're becoming very wise. We're not judging better or worse. And all this ego business of competition starts to disappear. And when we don't judge people better or worse, only then can we really have friends. So I ask you now, which is the best religion? Christianity, Buddhism, Hindu, or Judaism? Which is the best part of Buddhism? Mahayana, Theravada? Which is the best vehicle? Somebody said many years ago, big vehicle, small vehicle, all vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense. The point is that when we start to say that my type of Buddhism is better than your types of Buddhism, that's judging, that's conceit. That's missing the point of what the Buddha was talking about, of non-attachment, of non-ownership. So the point is that we have wisdom. And if it truly is wisdom, it is wisdom which never judges, which never thinks we're superior, or wisdom which never owns things, which can let things go, which can share. Why is it that people like to own things instead of sharing things? I can't see the point in that. There's plenty to go around if we could only share. But if we own it all by ourselves, then of course other people go without. Never makes sense to me. All because of the idea of ownership and self. When there's an idea of ownership and self, is my teacher is better than your teacher. My meditation is much better than your meditation. And we've got what this Tibetan monk once called spiritual materialism. How many retreats have you been to? 9. That's nothing. 99 retreats. I've been to 90 retreats. Beat that. Who's your teacher? Our teacher's Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, that's nothing. My teacher is whatever else it is. Sometimes we have that spiritual materialism, which I see in some of the disciples. I think, look, you're missing the point. We don't judge. You don't own things. You empty out. You let go of things. That's what wisdom means. Because with the emptying out of things, it's like you have less burdens to carry around in life. You don't have the burden of your teacher, of your religion to carry around. It's not a burden, it's a liberation. You don't have the burden of your possessions. How many people are possessed by their possessions rather than make use of their possessions? Are you really worried about all of your goods? There's this one fellow, one of these disciples. He only had one possession, which was a Harley Davidson motorcycle. It was actually worth about 60,000 or 70,000 Australian dollars. It was very, very expensive. And that was the only thing he had. He lived in rental houses. He only had a small number of clothes. He went from like small job to small job. But that was his pride and joy, his biggest possession. But he was a meditator, one of my disciples, and he told me one day, he went to the shopping mall, he parked the car, he got some goods, and when he came back to the car park, he noticed his motorbike had been stolen. And that was the only possession he had, $60,000 or $70,000. And as soon as it had been stolen, he remembered the Dhamma. It's not really mine anyway. Why am I going to make myself sad? It's been stolen, it's gone. All the crying won't make it come back. So he let it go. And he told me he was so proud of himself, he felt so good, that there someone had stolen the only possession he had, and he'd let it go. He abandoned it. He felt so good. And then he suddenly remembered he was on the wrong floor of the car park. And of course, he went to the correct floor, his bicycle was still there. And I said, no, it must have been, but actually changed the numbers of the car park just to give you a test. And it's such a great test for him, and he was so happy that, okay, he possessed his motorbike, but it never possessed him. He could let it go. Someone stole it, who knows? So it's great being able to have some people who are like that, who can actually use these things without being possessed by them, and that's called wisdom. You can actually have a husband, you can have a wife, but you're not possessed by them. If they happen to meet with an accident and they die, what a wonderful life we've had together. Oh, it's so great knowing you for that time. But you don't cry and think, oh, they're not going to be around anymore. Oh, what am I going to do without them? Or you're not going to give me happy. Hey, at last they've gone. Either way, you don't think like that. You're not possessed by hatred. You're not possessed by attachments. You enjoy each other's company and then you can let it go. Can you understand this way? Like, wisdom is freedom. So that grief never comes into you, hatred never comes into you, worry doesn't come into you. What is fear anyway? All fear is actually when an attachment of yours is being threatened. Something you think you own is about to be taken away. That's what fear is. If it's like fear of failure, there's some sort of ego, some sort of pride is being threatened. If it's fear of some lump in your breast, it's a fear that, oh, I'm going to die, this is cancer. Ah. If it's, you know, your husband comes back and he looks at you in a strange way, has he been out with some China girl somewhere? I was reading the Singapore newspapers last week. And it's like fear of your relationship being on the rocks, about something being taken away from you which you think you own. Now this is when you don't own anything, when you make use and enjoy these things as temporary temporary possessions, if you like, then you don't fear anything in the world. You truly can live free from fear. You understand what enlightenment truly means, a freedom from fear, an ability to enjoy the things which are around you without being possessed by them, to be able to walk in the world in a sense of freedom and peace. You can have wealth, but you're not possessed by it. You can have a family, but you can let it go if it's beyond your control, with sickness and death. You can have a body, but you can be free of your body. You can even be sick and not allow it to make your mind sick, as the Buddha said. Because you don't own this body, you say, oh, this is the body just getting old and sick, it's just dying. This is its nature. You can make peace with it. So a lot of our wisdom is learning that many things in life we can't fight. They belong to nature. It's a way of nature, so we allow it to be. We allow nature to be. Instead of trying to change the world, we change our attitude. Instead of trying to control the world, we actually control our minds by letting them go. Instead of fighting this great war, which is the war between our mind, what we want it to be, and the way the world is, the great war between our wants and desires and the nature of the world, we settle that war once and for all, not by changing the world to suit ourselves, but to change ourselves to suit the nature of the world. And that becomes wisdom. We pull ourselves in line with the world rather than trying to pull the world in line with us. And then of course we make peace. We make peace with the world. So when we have stillness, we can see things as they truly are. We know the nature of husbands. We know the nature of wives. We know the nature of marriage. We know the nature of children. We know the nature of having a body. We know the nature of going to work. We know the nature of sickness. When we know the nature, when we know the rules of the game, and we adapt ourselves to those rules, then we always will be at peace. We'll be able to let go. To let go and flow with the nature of things, rather than fighting battles which you can't win, which is called suffering. So wisdom, insight, actually comes from stillness. Being able to see deeply into things, as if, this is the way things are. There was this wonderful photo of my teacher, Ajahn Chah. He was imitating a statue at a monastery somewhere. It was a statue of this monk throwing their arms up, having just become enlightened. And the caption underneath this newly enlightened monk was, "Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world." Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. Do you understand that saying? It means there's no lasting happiness in this world. Joy at last. There's nothing wrong with me. You're not making a mistake. Actually, this is what life is like. You have happiness, you have suffering. You have health, you have sickness. Things go right and then things go wrong. And you don't blame the world, you don't blame yourself. Joy at last, I can let go. If things are suffering, that's fine with me. If they're happy, that's fine with me. Joy at last, to know there's no happiness in the world. So you can really let go and be free and just enjoy life. I'll finish off with a Zen story which comes to mind. There was this Japanese monk. The name will come to me a bit later. He was a very, very good monk, and he was staying up in the mountains meditating. He would go down to the village every few days for alms food. The people respected him, but he was a bit of an aloof monk, a meditator. They never knew exactly how wise he was. But in the village, one day, one of the village girls got pregnant. And of course, after a while, she couldn't hide the fact that she was pregnant. And so her father noticed it and started scolding her. And who was the culprit? Who did this to you? And of course, she was still in love with the boy who made her pregnant. And he knew that he'd be in big trouble if she told her father who it was. So, being in a bind, not wanting to incriminate the boy she loved, but having to give somebody as the name of the person who made her pregnant, she said on the spur of the moment, "The monk up in the hill, he did it." And the husband was so incensed. He was so upset. He called a meeting of the council of the village. "What should we do? This shameless monk has made my daughter pregnant." So they decided they couldn't actually hurt the monk or throw him in prison or beat him up because he was a monk. So they went up to that monk and they scolded him and they shouted at him and they accused him and they pointed a finger. They gave him a real big scolding. And this monk never defended himself. All he would do is say, "Aso, aso. Aso." You know, as they do in Japan, "Aso." When they finished shouting at him and they were finished getting hoarse, they went down to the village. And a few months later, when she gave birth to a baby girl. And the villagers thought, "No, we haven't really finished with that monk, let's punish him further." So they took the baby girl and they took it to the monk and said, "You're the father, you look after her." And he said, "Aso, aso." And he was a monk. Now how can a monk, like a man, look after a baby girl? But, you know, monks are resourceful. You can always do something with what you've got. And so he started looking after her. And of course, after a few weeks, the mother started missing her daughter. You know, as mothers do. "Is it only a baby?" And think, "Oh, what's she doing up there?" And so eventually she confessed. By that time, the boyfriend, you know, just before he knew he was in trouble, so he ran away. He didn't really love her, she loved him. He ran away into the town. So at that time she confessed to her father, "It wasn't a monk, it was this boy who's just run away. He was a culprit. I never wanted to tell you because I thought he'd get into trouble, and I still loved him." And of course the father understood, you know, the mind of his daughter. He didn't really punish her. She'd been punished enough by missing her girl. But he felt so guilty. He'd accused this monk. And this monk had been accused falsely of something he never did. Had been accused of having intercourse with his daughter and fathering the child. And they dumped this child on this holy monk. They felt so terrible. So they had another meeting and they decided the only thing to do was to go up and ask for forgiveness. So they went up to see that monk the third time. And they were crying, "Oh, we're so sorry, we've done such a terrible thing. You know, we sort of accuse you of this this terrible act which you didn't do. We gave you this girl to, you know, you're a monk, we terrible thing. Please forgive us. And all he would say was, also. And he'd just go back again. Because he was a monk with no attachment. He was accused of wrong things. He's not going to allow that to spoil his day. You can shout at me as much as you like. All he would say is, also. When they came and gave him the girl, he realized that all his protestations, no matter how much he argued, would just make matters worse. So, also, give me the girl, I'll look after her. When it was time to give the girl back, he didn't say, I told you so, why did you accuse me wrongly? All he did say is, also. And the moral of that story, when you're very, very wise, you have no attachment. When your wife scolds you, just say, also. And when she said, oh, I'm terribly sorry for saying that to you, husband, also. It reminds me of this other lovely story, which I haven't told you, because this is a Christian story. It comes from the story of the Franciscans. I told this in Perth a few days ago. It's a beautiful story. Because like other traditions have got their saints as well. And one of the people I really respect in Christianity is St. Francis. And there was a book written about his early disciples. And this one character, one of his disciples, he was a great monk. Because in the Franciscan order, they too would go for alms round. They were into simplicity, not owning many things, having few attachments. And this monk went for alms round one day, the Franciscan monk, somewhere in Italy somewhere. And there was a beggar. And the beggar sort of asked him for something. And the Franciscan monk said, look, I don't have things, I'm a monk. And the beggar said, look, I'm really hungry, I haven't got anything at all. I'm starving, haven't eaten for days. And the monk said, well, the only thing I've got is my robe. And the beggar said, that'll do. out of compassion, a monk is supposed to be compassionate, he took off his robe and gave it to the beggar. That's how much he would let go. And when he went back to the monastery, the monks there saw this naked person coming in and said, get out of here, there's no crazy people, and get some clothes on as well. They didn't recognize him. And after a while he said, it's me. And then when they recognized him, they said, oh, what happened to you? Were you robbed? Were you beaten? Was it thieves who stole your robe? And he told the story. No, there was a beggar who was so hungry, and the only thing I had to give him was my robe, so I gave it to him. And the monk thought, wow, that's really generous. That really is compassion. That's like a monk sort of doing as he teaches others. But please don't tell any beggars in KL this story, because I need my I need my robe to get in the airport. They won't let me get on the plane without them. So they took him to the storeroom and they gave him another robe. Now, from the stores. Now, the point was that as soon as the beggar got the robe from this monk, you know, all the beggars, they all talk to each other. There's the grapevine. The word got around that this monk was what we call a soft touch. So the next day when he went out for alms round, another beggar said, oh, I'm so hungry, I haven't eaten for days, can you give me something like your robe? And so out of kindness, he gave his robe away a second time. And when he went back to the monastery this time, they recognized him straight away. Oh, here he comes again, come in. And they gave him a second robe. And just like in Buddhism, it happened the third time. The next day too, he went to do some begging for alms. And a beggar asked for his robe. He gave him his robe. So he came back to the monastery naked the third time. And at this time, the abbot was waiting for him. He said, come, get a robe on and come into my room. And the abbot scolded him. He said, look, it's all right to be generous and to be compassionate and kind, but we've only got a certain amount of robes in the storeroom. And these are donated by our supporters. We can't keep giving away robes like this. And he scolded him and scolded and scolded him for over an hour. And this monk, he just put his head down. He never even said, arso. He never even tried to justify himself. He was being scolded for being kind, and that seemed a bit unfair. But this is the degree of the compassion of that monk. He took the scolding for over an hour, and when it was finished, the abbot told him to go back. He went back to his room. About half an hour later, he knocked at the abbot's door. And the abbot opened him. "What do you want?" And this monk said, "I've made you some soup. You've been shouting at me for over an hour. I thought you must have a sore throat." And he gave him, and he wasn't trying to be clever. He was just really compassionate. He was never thinking about himself, even though he was being scolded. He was thinking about his poor abbot who was speaking so long and so loud for such a time. "Here, have some soup. It will soothe your throat." So the moral of that story, if your husband has an argument with you and he shouts, 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 go make him some soup. "Oh, you poor thing, you must have a sore throat." Now the point of those stories is that real wisdom is like selflessness. So people can scold you, they can shout at you, you don't really think about yourself. You just think about, "Oh, that poor person scolded me, they must have such a sore throat. They must be in such a bad mood that they can scold me like that." You never think of yourself, you only think of them. From egolessness, from wisdom, flows compassion. So this is what we mean by transforming the mind. Making the mind still, seeing wisdom, having few possessions. You can have things, but don't possess them. And then learning how to share. And then learning that because there's no self in there, it's impossible to make you angry. And all you have left in the world is compassion for others. Because you don't think of yourself, because there's no self in there ever again. And that way you will truly have transformed your mind. A mind into something who's peaceful and kind. Someone who's a joy to live with. Someone only thinks of others, never of oneself. And I think that my voice is getting a bit hoarse now. So I'm going to stop and give myself some soup. Have you got something there? Okay. Very good. Okay. So, I've got one of each, and out of compassion, I will take both. Any questions now? There's actually a couple of questions lying in front of me here. So let's answer these ones first of all. And then we go on to other questions. You know the story in Buddhism about the elephants and the blind men. It's in my book. The story, which you probably have heard in the suttas, is extended in my book. The story of the blind men and the elephant is this. There was a king who was always having trouble with his ministers. They were always arguing who was right and who was wrong. And they never listened to each other. They'd always argue against each other. And the king, who was a wise person, decided to teach the ministers a lesson. He suggested a public holiday, and that was one thing all the ministers agreed upon. And part of the holiday, they had a big celebration in the stadium. There were dancers, musicians, acrobats. But the final part of the performance, the king led one of his royal elephants into the center of the arena. He went back into the tunnel and brought out 7 men who had been blind since the day they were born, who were well known in the town of being blind men. He took the first blind man and put his hand on the elephant's trunk and said, "Blind man, this is an elephant." This man had heard the word elephant before, but being blind had never seen one and never came close to one. Now he could actually feel it. He took the second blind man and put his hand on the ear, another blind man the hand on the tusk, one on the head, the next blind man on the body, the sixth blind man on one of the legs, and the last blind man, number 7, he put his hand on the tail of the elephant and said, "Blind man, this is an elephant." He let each of the blind men feel the elephant for a certain amount of time. Then he asked each blind man in turn to explain in a loud voice to the crowd what an elephant was. And the one who felt the trunk said, "In my opinion, and I'm never wrong, because I can feel this is from my own experience, not from theory, from experience, an elephant is a snake. It's a large type of snake, like a python, that's what an elephant is." And the second guy, who was feeling the tusk, said, "No way can it be a snake. Snakes aren't hard like this. An elephant is a plough. It's a type of plough which the farmers use to dig the earth. You crazy guy, said the one who felt the ears. It's a fan which people use to cool themselves with. It can't be a snake. It can't be a plough. You're all wrong, said the guy who felt the head. It's a water pot. No, it's not. It's a rock. It's a tree, said the one who thinks. I am the only one who knows what it is, said the guy who felt the tail. It's a fly whisk. You are all wrong. I can feel it. I can feel it right now. I can tell people with absolute certainty a elephant is a fly whisk. And of course, everyone was accurate according to their limited experience. But they had an argument. And according to the story, they started fighting. How blind men could start fighting, I'm not quite sure. But they were doing it anyway. At which they were separated by the soldiers. And of course, the ministers got the message of the object lesson. Each one of us, even in religions, only knows part of the truth. But we think that we know all of the truth. In a marriage, each one of you has only got limited experience and knowledge. But when you think that I am right and everyone else is wrong, that this is the only truth, that's where we have fights. So when some religion thinks that this is the only truth, that's when we have the wars and the conflicts. And instead of having those conflicts, this is how I added to that old Buddhist story. Wouldn't it be better if those seven blind men, instead of having a conflict, instead of arguing against each other, sat down and compared notes, combined their experience, rather than conflicting their experience? And then they would have decided, if they'd have come together, that an elephant is a big rock on four tree trunks with a fly whisk in the back, a water pot on the front, with a snake in the middle, two fans on either side, and two ploughs just behind just on either side of the snake. And to a blind man, that would be a pretty good description of an elephant. Now, can you see what I mean about, instead of conflicting and arguing against each other, if we say, how do you experience things? How do I experience things? And actually joining our experience together and benefiting from each other's world views. That is the way forward in our world, or even in a community, in a marriage. Instead of arguing who's right and who's wrong, we actually listen to each other. There's an old story in conflict management about these two ladies who were fighting over an orange. One of them said, you had the orange last time, it's my turn. No, it's my turn, I want it. No, I want it. And so they got a person to adjudicate. Actually, they adjudicated with themselves. They decided that they'd cut the orange in half and have half each. And the first woman peeled the orange. They threw the peel away and they ate the orange, or half an orange. The other lady peeled the orange. They threw the flesh of the orange away because they only wanted the peel to make a cake. If they'd only talked to each other instead of arguing, instead of, I want the orange. Why do you want the orange? I want the orange for the peel. I want the orange for the flesh. They could have both had twice as much as they got if they hadn't argued. And so much argument is like that. We don't talk to each other. And we don't combine our understanding. If we combined our understanding and knowledge, we'll have a much more harmonious, a wiser, and a richer world. So this is actually what the story of the elephant. Instead of conflict, we listen, we understand from each other. Anyway, speaking of expecting nothing out of meditation, if you do meditation with the intention of sharing the merits with others or transferring the merits to the departed ones, will this be considered craving? Well, actually, you don't get anything by sharing the merits with others. It's actually all giving away again. It's like a letting go. So it's not considered really as craving. It's considered of letting go and giving. You're meditating for the sake of others. You know, there's this big conflict in the Buddhist circles about Mahayana and Theravada. People say that all the Theravada monks are selfish. We just want to have our own enlightenment. whereas all the Mahayana monks are working so hard for the benefit of others. And which monk am I? Sometimes I get confused because I work so hard for the sake of others, but I was supposed to be a Theravada. Now the point is that when you let go of self, which is the whole path of enlightenment, when you let go, become enlightened, you give to other people. It's compassion. You become enlightened for the sake of other beings, never for the sake of yourself. That's selfishness. You can't do it for yourself. It will never work. So the idea of a selfish arahat is crazy to me. I can't understand where the idea came from. All enlightened beings are compassionate, just like the Buddha. So when you actually end craving, when you stop craving what I want, what I need, then of course you share. So sharing is the opposite of craving. Giving merits is the opposite of being selfish. So if you're doing meditation to share the merits, it is not expecting anything for yourself. It's not wanting anything. It's another form of letting go. And always think about this, that if you meditate, if you keep precepts, become a more pure-hearted person, become a kinder person, a more liberated person, a more enlightened person, it's a wonderful gift for the people you live with. So being at peace means that you can give that peace to others. If you are at war, you only give war to others. If you are angry inside, you give anger to others. So if only for the sake of the people you live with, be peaceful, be kind. If you've got a pure mind, people around you have a wonderful time. So you meditate for the sake of others. You keep precepts for the sake of others. You're wise for the sake of others. So really, it is a selfless practice. In brief, there is, in practice, in reality, no difference between the Bodhisattva way and the Arahat way. They are the same. You get enlightened for the ultimate benefit of all other beings. For the benefit of all other beings, you become enlightened. They are the same. Do you understand? So sharing of merits, giving away, this is letting go. So that's fine. You can meditate and then give away all of your merits, every one of them. Empty yourself out. All my merits, all my good karma, you can have the whole lot. And then you get even more. Western Buddhist philosophy to success teaches goal setting, persistence, eyes in conflict with the Buddhist teachings, of course. Those people who actually teach these things never practice them. They want to teach these things, make a lot of money, and then go home. Because if these people were actually teaching business philosophy, if they were any good, they'd be millionaires by now. They wouldn't need to sort of go and teach things and work all day. Sometimes I really wonder, you see in the newspapers, how to make a lot, how to make yourself a millionaire on the stock market. And if these people really knew how to be a millionaire from the stock market, what would they be doing, wasting their time, wasting their energy, working and teaching other people? There's an old saying, I don't know if I should say this, but I've already gone too far now. They say, those who can, do. Those who can't, teach others. See, I'm a bit troubled now because I've just been teaching all day. But it's very true of, like, you know, business philosophy or people who teach those courses. If they were successful business people, they'd be so wealthy, they'd be on some yacht somewhere. They wouldn't be in universities or hotels teaching people. So basically they teach a lot of rubbish. If it's persistence, etc., you try that, being persistent, being persistent, being persistent, you end up in the mental home. Eventually you get frustrated. There's some things you just can't do. So sometimes persistence, etc., is a goal for success. It really is just the path of frustration and despair. Set yourself the goal of just being present, the goal of being at peace, the goal of being happy, that's enough. And your goal should always be changing. Be changing to the situation, to the circumstances. You adapt. What was it in the, that book which was written, Who Moved My Cheese? I know that book very well because I like cheese in the afternoon. So I hope no one's moved my cheese which was in my room before I left this afternoon. The point is that you know, your goal has to be changed. It's not always over there, it's over here and over there. You follow what the appropriate thing is in the moment. So too much planning makes you too fixed that you can't adapt to the changing situations of life. And that's why no goals means you can set different goals all the time. You can adapt to life, always being adaptive, resourceful. And that's certainly how I've lived my monastic life, taking opportunities as they arise, rather than always have a fixed idea of how things should be done. Let's see what other questions there are here. If a person is not devotional, like doing pujas and chanting, but practices Buddhist philosophy like the Four Noble Truths, Eight Noble Paths, does that make him a bad or incomplete Buddhist if you're not devotional? I was never devotional when I started off being a Buddhist. I was just into meditation, just the hard stuff, not this soft chanting business, because I was a scientist. I wanted the fast path to enlightenment. None of this superstitious nonsense. But actually, if you, it doesn't matter where you start, if you really start with like the philosophy and then you start putting into practice, you find that devotion just happens. It's a part of the path. You know, devotion is so close to compassion. You get so much compassion and gratitude to your teachers. You get so much devotion to them, so much love and care for those people who've helped you. And these days, I've got so much devotion to chanting and to, you know, things like Buddha statues. It was in just the end of this month, I'm leading about 60 people on one of the pilgrimages to India. And this is, I don't know how many times I've been doing this, but every time I go there, there's certain places I just burst out crying. One of the places is the Vulture's Peak. I love that place, because that's the place where the Buddha would sit meditation. And that's the place where he taught so many great sutras. You just go up there and you just sit meditation. I just start crying. Just, this is a Buddhist place, and it's just so much power. I got so much devotion up there. And I enjoy that. Having a good cry as a monk, from pity, from joy, from inspiration, is wonderful. So it's actually those positive emotions I've learned to encourage. And one of the positive emotions is devotion. It's part of the path. You don't have to do it. It just happens. You've got no choice. It's just what happens. It's part of the process. As your faith and devotion gets more and more and more. In fact, it's at the moment of stream winning, when you see the Dhamma, you understand what the Buddha is, that your devotion gets incredibly strong. You have this amazing devotion to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And it's so firm and solid, it will never be shaken. And just the mention of those words will send shivers up your spine and joy to your heart. It's not something which you construct. You don't play about in these things. It just happens by nature. Because, you know, the Buddha, the person who started these amazing teachings, which liberate you from samsara, which give you so much peace and so much joy and meaning in life, that will just make you cry. Tears of joy and happiness is the greatest teacher. And even your own teachers, whoever they would be, when you start thinking about them, they gave you one of the greatest gifts. You have like the gratitude to your parents, but your spiritual parents, that gratitude and devotion knows no bounds. You just want to hug them. Sometimes those first teachers, if I saw them passing, even though it's against my rules to bow to them, it'd be hard for me to stop. Just to grab them by the feet and just bow, 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 bow. Because this is what comes from your heart, the emotions of devotion. And to this beautiful Dhamma and the Sangha, all those great teachers I've known, you feel so much love and devotion towards them. And it's nature. And it's not an unwholesome quality of the mind, but it's something which actually leads you to nirvana. So it's something which happens, which you should allow to happen, which gives you great happiness and joy, which you don't fake it, don't sort of play around with these things. Allow it to happen as a natural phenomenon, and then you can enjoy it. Allow it to happen, and it will empower you on your path to meditation. Many people start their meditation with some chanting or with some reflections on the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha, and it really helps the meditation. You get so much energy up by thinking of your teachers, or by thinking of the Buddha, or thinking of those places where he used to live. You get so much joy, you start meditating, or you're right back there. You have a wonderful time in meditation. It works. So devotion, if it comes naturally, is good. If it doesn't come naturally, leave it alone, it'll come later on. Having visited and taught in Malaysia for many years, how do you find in general Malaysians have difficulty feeling and sharing emotions? Seems like we conduct our Dhamma practice and relationship like transactions or business, either amongst each other and maybe even between ourselves and the Buddhas. Could you share your thoughts and maybe try again to help us develop the necessary transformation to integrate Dhamma into our interactions with each other? Oh, you know, it all happens quite naturally. And I've seen that happening with a few people I've known after a while. You're smiling much more, you're more relaxed, you're laughing much more. There's a greater sense of fellowship, and there's a greater sense of encouraging the emotional part of Buddhism as well, whether it's friendship and joy. People laugh more in the last 3 or 4 years. I know the Chief Reverend has been trying to teach that for years, but people have been a bit too stiff. They have. But yeah, but I keep on trying as well, make people smile and be happy and have joy. And when they do, I realize that they're getting somewhere in their life and in their practice of meditation. Yeah, you might start off as a business deal, but it goes much deeper than that. It touches the heart. And you get compassion, you get joy coming up. The real stuff, not playing around. And you get this friendship with, you know, people from other traditions of Buddhism and other types of religion. I always say, if it really is truth, it must bring people together and bring them happiness. It can't create more barriers in the world. If it really is truth, it must make your marriage even better, make your feeling to yourself even more strong and more at peace, and make your feelings towards other people, even your enemies, just those bad feelings fade away, be replaced by friendship and mutual respect. If it really is Dhamma, it's pure in all of its results. It brings harmony, brings peace, brings happiness into the world. And after a while, that certainly when it's been happening, in especially in meditation retreats, I know it happened in the retreat in Champaka, a few people started crying. They had to go back to their rooms to cry because they were embarrassed. But I said, no, please, next time, cry in public, because I want you to teach other people the importance of crying. And it's okay to do so. Because sometimes something hits you in a Dhamma talk or in your meditation. And it's not tears of pain or tears of disappointment. It's just tears of joy. And that happens even more regularly in Australia. And most of the Australian disciples were ex-English people who were supposed to have a stiff upper lip. But I managed to massage that stiff upper lip and make it sort of all wobbly. And see, like, grown men just cry their eyes out. There's one of the disciples in Singapore, when I did my first retreat in Singapore, it was in Sentosa. And he came up to me afterwards, he said, that's the first time I've cried, I think it was about 12-13 years. And that shocked him. He thought he was in complete control of his emotions, and I broke through and he cried. And you know, that made him a disciple for life. And he was a great guy and a much better husband as a result. So he got in touch with his emotions, he let go and they flowed out. Health-wise, it's wonderful. And practice-wise, it's wonderful. You know, it's one thing I say about the deep meditations, the jhanas. Those jhanas are emotional states. You have to feel your way into those jhanas. You can't think your way. And it's because of that that, generally speaking, women have a much better chance getting into jhana than men do. From my experience, more women get into jhana than men. But the women have a slower time, they take longer understanding the meaning of those jhanas. So when the men do get into the jhanas, they understand what they mean very quickly, they get insight quickly. So in the end, it evens out. And I'm not just saying that to be diplomatic. That's the truth of things. But it actually, I mention that because it shows everybody that you have to feel those jhanas. It's an emotional, feely-feely state. And when you understand that, you have to be confident with those feelings. Especially incredible sense of energy and joy in your heart. Very, very strong emotions of joy and stillness. And if you're not used to that, you get afraid. Some men think they're out of control because they're not used to that area of their life. But little by little, you let go and you find you get more happiness, you get deeper in meditation, further on the spiritual path, and you realize it's good. Really, you're getting more in touch and more at ease with the powerful emotions inside of you. So you are much more easy to cry and be at peace with your emotions. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah.
Sorry? Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Sometimes they have this idea in the Deva realms of they mostly talked about men in the sutras. And the men, they went in these Deva realms and had these 500 nymphs, devis, looking after them. Now, does that mean that if a woman goes to heaven, they have to spend all their time looking after men again? That's not heaven as far as many women are concerned. And the point is that in those heaven realms, in those hell realms, if a man goes up to heaven, that's what he imagines, that's how he describes it. It's not real people being the consorts or being the devis. That's how he imagines it, how he visualizes it. If it's a real woman, you know, if you go up to the heaven realm, you don't have to serve husbands and all that sort of stuff anymore. You've got your mansion and your pleasures. That's actually how you experience it. So there are many, many women, many, many men in the Deva realms. So it's pretty even. In fact, it's usually there's more women than men in the Deva realms. But I think it's because actually the women actually do more good karma. Look at the people here. I'm not sure what the numbers are, but it's usually like, you know, 2/3 of women, about 1/3 of men. That's usually average. So you can understand what it's going to be like when you go to heaven. The women are going to be in control. They've got the numbers. He's shaking his head. Okay, this is a short way of going. Ajahn, wait. Oh, yes, listen, I did that one already. Okay, let's do this one. Okay. Here we go. What are blessings? Do we need them? How do we get blessings? What advice would you give to help us develop daily practice? Okay. What are blessings? Like sometimes at the end of a retreat, I give you a blessing, give you some chanting. And again, when I started as a Buddhist, I didn't believe anything of that blessings. But then over the years, you start to see them work. They actually do help people. First of all, it's because maybe people believe the power of the blessings, but it actually is much more than that. And one of the things which I quote these days, if any of you are familiar with the internet, I would advise you to key in the words H for Henry, A for Anthony, D for Dennis, O for Orange, H-A-D-O, into Google and see what comes up. You'll come up with a website of a professor in Japan who's done some very fascinating experiments with bowls of water. It's H-A-D-O, H-A-D-O. It's very easy to remember, H-A-D-O. And what he's actually done, he got his students, sometimes 300 or 400 at a time, to sit around a bowl of water, and all together for half an hour or an hour, to think a certain type of thought, to try and spread a certain emotion to that water. And having spread a certain emotion, it could be gratitude, it could be hatred, it could be jealousy, it could be fear, it could be love, whatever. Then he would actually freeze the water very slowly and just to see how it crystallized. And he took photos of those crystals. And what he found is you get different crystalline shapes depending upon the emotions of the students surrounding that bowl. And what was really fascinating, that you could tell that the beautiful shapes, the beautiful crystals, all came from beautiful emotions. And when the emotions were negative, the crystalline shape was all over the place. The ones which I saw when I last keyed into that site and printed it out, and I got the printouts in my room in Australia, one of the emotions, he told about 500 students sitting around a bowl to think the thought, "You make me sick," for half an hour. And the crystal was terrible. It was all over the place. It was very irregular and unformed, yeah, and just ugly. And the other crystal was, he said, the most beautiful crystal he ever got was when the students around him were asked to think thoughts of gratitude. He got this beautiful crystal coming out. And he put those in a book. And it was actually showing that, like, emotions, thoughts, can actually affect water. Each one of you is made up of, was it 99% water? So can't those... Sorry? 70%. Well, some people drink a lot more than... I think that's enough to have some effect. So if that's the case, that we can actually have blessings. And so if I wish you, you know, may you be happy and may you be well, it works. And I've proved that in my monastery. I said this in some or other recently. We have a monastery cat who is now 18 years of age. Very, very healthy. And you know, it looks like an ordinary cat, still runs around the forest. And 18 years is a very old age for a cat. But it's very, very healthy. And sometimes people ask you, why is it so healthy? And I say, because every day it hears blessings from the monks. And there's proof, it's healthy and lives a long life. And the other thing which I've told my disciples in Perth, that they actually shake their heads because there's some truth to this. It's a strange thing, but it's been such a long time since I've done a funeral service for any of my disciples in Perth. Many, many years. They haven't died. Of course, they will die eventually, but at the moment, it's very, very pronounced. Why? So many of the students are still alive. They're very, very old, and none of them have died for a long time. Usually expect, you know, 2 or 3 funerals or more a year with all those disciples we have. It's been a long time. I do funerals for people who don't come to the temple, but not for people who come to the temple.